a little bit about our concerns regarding Keith Ellison. We do not feel that Keith Ellison will be impartial enough to directly oversee prosecution in this case. So what we are calling for is the appointment of a completely independent special prosecutor to oversee this case, preferably someone from outside the state of Minnesota with a strong national reputation, a person who's credible, a person who is known for being fair and just.
We have 10 seconds.
In cases like this.
Nikema Levy-Armstrong, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Civil rights attorney, activist, founder of the Racial Justice Network, former president of the Minneapolis chapter of the NAACP. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our remarkable team is working from home. If you'd like to sign up for our daily digest, our daily newsletter, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamara Studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG, a documentary slideshow screening. On Friday, June 5th, from 6:30 to 8 p.m., live streaming on Zoom. This slideshow depicts part two of Barbara Bernstein's radio documentary series, Holding the Thin Green Line, which explores what is at stake in Southern Oregon if the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and Pacific Connected Gas Pipeline get built. After the screening, there will be a Q&A session with impacted landowners, community organizers, and land and water protectors featured in the documentary. Again, that's The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG, a documentary slideshow screening, on Friday, June 5th, from 6:30 to 8 p.m., live streaming on Zoom. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, protests continued last night in Portland and across the country over the killing of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis. Mayor Ted Wheeler announced he will not be extending the citywide curfew for Tuesday night, and active-duty military have been asked to deploy in the nation's capital. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 2nd, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Protests continued last night in Portland and across the country over the killing of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis. KBOO was at the protests in Portland, and here are some clips of protesters and speeches from last night.
Hey, if y'all tired of how American is ran, say, I'm tired!
I'm tired!
I'm tired!
I'm tired!
I'm tired! George Floyd, he said, I can't breathe.
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 We are out here for one thing and one thing only. We are out here for change and for justice.
We are taught, being a person of color, you are taught, you are raised, like you have to either be violent and aggressive towards your oppressor or be docile. I don't want that to be the only choice. You have a choice to make a change for the future. We're not doing that now, but we're making that choice right this instant. Think before you act. I know this is high tension. We have a lot of emotions. I know things may go south, but think before you act, please, because you have to be aware of the people around you. The thing is, we aren't being aware with our actions. I know some people care and want to help, but I also know those actions can sometimes hurt the people you're trying to help. Please just be aware, educate, be vocal, communicate. We are here as one.
People that don't know me, my name is Life Tavares, L-Y-F-E Tavares. We are all here. We all saw the video. We all know what's going on in America. Hey, listen up. I'm gonna tell you just like this. We have a voice. Listen. You should never feel silenced as an individual. You should never feel silenced as an individual, all right? I would be lying to you if I said that change is gonna come tomorrow or a month from now. It might take some time. It might take some years.
I just wanna reiterate, educate yourself. This is much more than just race. This is class war. There is a tiny amount of people with the most amount of money who are running things. There's mutual aids. There's free lunch collective. Look these things up. Donate your money, your time, your ideas. There are no bad ideas, right? Well, there's some bad ideas. But if you want actual change, if you're tired of the system, there's something we can do. We're not powerless. We outnumber them. In 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated. For the next 6 days, over 100 cities rioted. They were angry. And you know what happened 6 days later? The Civil Rights Act of 1968. And you know how that happened? It happened because we're doing exactly what we're doing right now.
We want justice.
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 We need justice.
We need justice.
Hands up, don't shoot.
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 We want justice.
We want justice.
We need justice.
We need justice.
We want justice.
We want justice.
We need justice.
We need justice.
Make some noise for George Floyd.
Mayor Ted Wheeler held a press conference this morning speaking on the recent unrest in the city. KBOO's Al Khan has the story.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler held a press conference this morning to address the ongoing protests sparked by the death of George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis police last week. During his remarks, Wheeler said he will not be extending the citywide curfew that has been imposed the last 3 nights. The mayor pointed to last night's demonstration at Pioneer Square, which has been described as largely peaceful, unlike previous nights in which protesters and police have clashed. Wheeler called the difference in tone, quote, a significant shift, and is also quoted saying, what we are witnessing is an extraordinary moment in history, people coming together, united, to support the black community. Wheeler also used the opportunity to clarify his request to the governor for National Guard troops to be deployed in Portland, in direct confrontation with protesters, stating he never suggested for the troops to be used on the front line doing crowd control, just to serve in a supportive role protecting property. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
Many people view the current age of mass incarceration as a successor to segregation and the racist policies of the Jim Crow era. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Policing has been the focal point of protests since George Floyd's death last week. A criminal justice reform advocate says we also need to understand them as a reaction to mass incarceration. Executive Director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center, Bobin Singh, says if we focus on singular aspects of the criminal justice system, such as policing, we won't understand the root causes of violence, such as Floyd's death.
If we actually begin to look at how all these systems work together to push on certain populations, to control certain populations, to brutalize certain populations, then we begin to see how that thread exists, and we can then pull on it to be able to begin to undermine it and frustrate it.
Singh says the age of mass incarceration is seen as the successor to segregation and the racist policies of the Jim Crow era. Police have responded to marches against police brutality in Oregon with tear gas and rubber bullets. In Portland and Eugene, protests have ended with fires and property damage. But Singh criticizes the fact that some cities have responded to protesters with a greater police presence.
We don't even, as a country or as cities, understand with clarity how they're hurting and why they're hurting. We respond in the most insensitive and in the most harmful way by doubling down on sort of like this law and order mentality that has produced this problem.
Singh says Oregon may have a reputation for being progressive, but it has followed the rest of the nation when it comes to sharply increasing its prison population in racially biased ways.
The tough on crime stuff that's existed and helped propped up mass incarceration, Oregon is not different from the country. We're part of that national phenomenon that's existed over the past two or three decades that's ramped up our system of incarceration.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Earlier this morning, President Trump threatened the nation's governors with military intervention over ongoing protests in the aftermath of the police killing of George Floyd. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has more on that story.
After 3 days of nationwide protests and unrest in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers, Donald Trump clearly demonstrated his lack of empathy for his fellow citizens and his disdain for their constitutional rights in a series of high-profile events on Monday. It started with a morning conference call with the nation's governors, during which Trump threatened them with military intervention and demanded that the governors begin mass arrests.
We've got a number of people here that you'll be seeing a lot of. General Milley is here, a fighter, a warrior, had a lot of victories, had no losses. And he hates to see the way it's being handled in the various states, and I've just put him in charge. We're strongly looking for arrests. You have to get much tougher. You have to dominate. If you don't dominate, you're wasting your time. They're going to run over you. You're going to look like a bunch of jerks. You have to arrest people, and you have to try people, and they have to go to jail for long periods of time.
Later, in comments to reporters in the Rose Garden, Trump doubled down by announcing his plan to use the military while dog-whistling his base with references to law and order, as well as the Second Amendment.
I swore an oath to uphold the laws of our nation, and that is exactly what I will do. I will fight to protect you. I am your president of law and order and an ally of all peaceful protesters. That is why I am taking immediate presidential action to stop the violence and restore security and safety in America. I am mobilizing all available federal resources, civilian and military, to stop the rioting and looting, to end the destruction and arson, and to protect the rights of law-abiding Americans, including your Second Amendment rights.
And despite his claim that he was an ally of peaceful protesters, federal law enforcement officers cleared those peaceful protesters out of Lafayette Park adjacent to the White House. The action took place during live television coverage to the horror of both the viewing audience and the newscasters who watched helplessly as the officers fired tear gas and volleys of rubber bullets into the protesters. The clearing of the park brought a rare bipartisan rebuke from Congress. Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer said that Trump was, quote, pleased with himself for descending another rung on the dictatorial ladder, end quote. And Republican Ben Sasse of Nebraska referred to the constitutional right to protest and said, quote, I'm against clearing out a peaceful protest for a photo op that treats the word of God as a political prop. In comments on NBC's Today Show this morning, the Right Reverend Marion Edgar Buddy, the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, the diocese responsible for St. John's Church, said this.
His officials cleared peaceful protests with tear gas and horses and walked onto the courtyard of St. John's Church and held up a Bible as if it were a prop or an extension of his military and authoritarian position and stood in front of our building as if it were a backdrop for his agenda. I was deeply disappointed that he did not take the opportunity. He didn't come to church to pray. He didn't come to church to offer condolences to those who were grieving. He didn't come to commit to healing our nation, all the things that we would expect and long for from the highest leader in the land.
For KBOO, I'm Ray Bodwell.
Active duty military forces have been called to deploy in Washington, D.C. With more, we go again to KBOO's Al Khan.
A battalion of military police consisting of between 200 and 250 soldiers from Fort Bragg has been ordered by the Pentagon to deploy to the Washington, D.C. area. The troops, which could be in the Capitol as early as tonight, are said to be coming for security purposes only and not to be used to assist local police in the arrest or detention of protesters or rioters. Due to the unique status of Washington, D.C., this deployment does not require the authorization of local authorities, nor does it require Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act of 1807, although he threatened on Monday to deploy active-duty military forces to U.S. cities, which would require his invoking of this act. Trump announced that Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Army General Mark Milley, would be in charge of the military action, though he was unclear at the time of the exact role Milley would play. White House Press Secretary Kylie McKinney told reporters later in the day that Milley will oversee a command center, but would not provide any additional details. This action by Trump comes after he tweeted support for Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton's comments to call for the deployment of active duty combat units, naming the 82nd Airborne Division, the 10th Mountain Division, the 101st Airborne, 10th Mountain Division, 1st Cavalry, and the 3rd Infantry Division, calling for them to do, quote, whatever it takes to restore order. The Pentagon has also put military police from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, Fort Drum, New York, and Fort Riley, Kansas, on alert in anticipation of a possible deployment to Minneapolis. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of Counterspin, produced by the media watchdog group FAIR. At 6, we'll hear Transpositive PDX, then at 7, it's Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 52 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 74. Today in history, in 1865, the commander of the Confederate forces west of the Mississippi signs the surrender terms offered by Union negotiators, an event that is generally regarded as marking the end of the Civil War. The quote of the day is from writer and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, who said in his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, quote, "We must always take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented." Chief of police in Louisville, Kentucky, has been fired after officials discovered two police officers involved in the fatal shooting of a black man during a protest over George Floyd's death had not activated their body cameras. Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher said on Monday, quote, "This type of institutional failure will not be tolerated. Accordingly, I have relieved Steve Conrad of his duties as chief of the Louisville Metro Police Department." Fisher identified the victim as David McAtee, a local business owner. McAtee was shot as police and the National Guard were trying to disperse protesters in the area. The officers claimed they returned fire after they were shot at first. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear said the state police will be investigating McAtee's death alongside the FBI. Protests have erupted across the nation after George Floyd was killed by police in Minneapolis. In Louisville, the protests have centered on the death of Breonna Taylor, an emergency medical technician who was shot multiple times when officers entered her apartment by force in the middle of the night. A bipartisan effort in Congress is attempting to shut down a Pentagon program that transfers military weaponry to local law enforcement departments. This comes as urgency builds to address the excessive use of force and the killings of unarmed Black Americans by police. Lawmakers are questioning the Defense Department initiative that provides police departments with equipment, such as bayonets and grenade launchers. Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii has long pushed to limit the transfer of military-grade equipment to police departments. Schatz announced that he would move to include an amendment in the must-pass annual defense policy bill to shut down the program entirely. He said, quote, "It is clear that many police departments are being outfitted as if they are going to war, and it is not working in terms of maintaining the peace." The program was created in the 1990s in an effort to offload surplus military equipment and aid police departments during the war on drugs. It was then expanded in the wake of the September 11th attacks. President Obama placed limits on the program in 2015. However, Trump reversed those restrictions in 2017, arguing the gear was necessary for officers to protect themselves and their communities. The so-called voter purge case in Wisconsin is being watched nationally because the state is considered a toss-up in the presidential election. Mike Moen has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The issue of whether nearly 130,000 Wisconsin residents should be removed from the voter rolls has resurfaced as the state Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case. The controversy arose after state election officials sent letters to residents who had possibly moved to confirm whether they had a new address. Election Commission policy gives recipients until 2021 to respond or risk losing their voter registration status. But a conservative group took legal action, claiming the response window should only be 30 days. Bruce Colburn heads a voting rights group and says this type of action has had a negative impact on voters in the past.
Many examples where they had the wrong information about the person, where the information was that the person had moved within the area, which is, means that they shouldn't be purged.
Colburn accuses the conservative-leaning court of taking an overtly political stance in a state where President Donald Trump nearly defeated Hillary Clinton in 2016. In a split ruling earlier this year, the Wisconsin Supreme Court had declined to hear the case. Supporters of the shorter response window say it could prevent voter fraud and that their argument is backed by state law, not the commission's policy. Colburn, who is based in Milwaukee with the group Souls to the Polls, says the timing is especially troubling for minority voters who have consistently had access issues in elections.
In the central city, again, where there's confusion sometimes over dates and where people are living, and that sort of thing. So again, it always goes to the people who have the least ability to defend themselves.
The court has scheduled a 60-day window to hear arguments in the case. It's unclear yet whether the High Court will make a decision before the November election. Mike Moen, Public News Service. Support for this reporting comes from the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
Eight states plus Washington, D.C. have primaries today. Meanwhile, cities are figuring out how to move forward in the wake of massive protests nationwide, and President Trump says he will deploy active U.S. troops to quell them. With more on those stories, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
We're in uncharted territory in terms of first the pandemic and now kind of the civil unrest that we're seeing in a lot of cities. How that affects the mechanics of voting, I think, is still an open question.
Reporter Jacob Rubashkin with Inside Elections on today's primaries in the midst of massive nationwide protests. Yesterday, during remarks about the police killing of George Floyd, President Donald Trump threatened to deploy active duty U.S. troops to quell protests in the states where governors don't deploy their own National Guards. Former Vice President Joe Biden, on the other hand, joined a peaceful protest the day before and spoke with community leaders at Bethel AME, a Black church in Wilmington, Delaware. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms joined Biden and three other mayors for a virtual discussion on where cities go from here.
What I want us to see in Atlanta and across this country is I want us to see some hope that things will be better tomorrow.
Georgia has its primaries next week. Today it's Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., Iowa, New Mexico, Rhode Island, Indiana, Maryland, Montana, and South Dakota. One of the races to watch is a strong challenge to incumbent Republican Congressman Steve King in Iowa's 4th congressional district. King made national headlines after making racist comments in the New York Times last year, which cost him important committee assignments. Iowa journalist Laura Bellin from political website Bleeding Heartland says the primary challenge to King is less because of his racist remarks and more because of his general election vulnerability in a deep red district that should be a GOP stronghold. But in 2018, Democrat J.D. Schulting came within 3 percentage points.
Until J.D. Schulting almost beat Steve King, the Republican establishment in Iowa was perfectly happy to tolerate Steve King and all of his bigoted rhetoric. Our governor invited him to be one of her campaign co-chairs. Joni Ernst enthusiastically endorsed him in his 2016 primary.
Mainstream Republican leaders have distanced themselves from King and funded Iowa State Senator Randy Feenstra. Still, Bellin can't shake the feeling that King might pull out a victory today.
It's really hard to know, but I think there's a quiet reservoir of support for Steve King out there.
Some Kansas Republicans worry their own polarizing candidate could put a Senate seat up for grabs for the first time in close to a century of state history. Here's Inside Elections' Rubashkin again.
It's the longest unbroken streak of Republican control of the Senate seat in the country.
The crowded Republican primary includes Kris Kobach, the hardline Trump ally and failed 2018 governor candidate. Kansas Republicans had wanted U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to run. The filing deadline was yesterday. Democrats are rallying behind Barbara Beaulieu, a former Republican and an anesthesiologist. Rubashkin says her medical credentials are a big plus with the pandemic.
As much as a Democrat can be a good fit for the state of Kansas, she falls into that category. So if it is Kobach versus Beaulieu, you're going to see a lot of consternation from Republicans.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The Wind River Reservation stays locked down as Wyoming eases its COVID-19 restrictions. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As Wyoming's statewide COVID-19 restrictions are eased, the Wind River Reservation is staying locked down. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports.
When the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes first put a stay-at-home order in place on April 1st, Shoshone Councilwoman Karen Snyder urged state and local officials to follow suit.
I would love to see the state of Wyoming and Fremont County do those stay-at-home orders. It just makes us stronger.
But Wyoming remained one of a handful of states that never issued a shelter-in-place. Now, tribal leaders have extended the strict stay-at-home order and nightly curfew through the end of June, as mass testing on the Wind River Reservation continues to identify new cases every day. But Northern Arapaho Councilman Stephen Fasthorse says the tribe's orders can only be so effective when border towns like Lander and Riverton are opening up.
It really takes a lot out of our efforts, because on the main areas where we have to go to get the necessities, it's wide open.
Both tribes are urging their members to wear masks and gloves and practice social distancing while shopping in border towns. At least 7 of Wyoming's 17 COVID-19 related deaths have been among Northern Arapaho tribal members. Fasthorse says the strict measures on Wind River are intended to prevent further loss of life. For National Native News, I'm Savannah Marr.
In Minneapolis, Minnesota, Monday, the Native American community gathered for a jingle dress healing dance in response to the death of George Floyd. In a Facebook video by Women's Indigenous Media, jingle dress dancers gathered to dance as a drum group sang at the site where a memorial is set up for George Floyd. Athena Cloud was one of the jingle dress dancers. She felt the need to share the dance, describing it as a spiritual cleansing for people in the Twin Cities, the nation, and for the family of Floyd.
We were all there with each other, with one another. And it didn't feel like it was divided. It felt like we were all able to come together and feel like we belonged to one community. We were one solid group there. We had speakers coming onto the megaphone, sharing their stories. And when someone felt like they were going to break down, people around them held them up, because we utilized each other to build on our strengths as individuals.
Cloud and other members of the Native community are also volunteering around the city to help with cleanup efforts and other needs.
Community coming together to help clean up and help ensure that the communities that are being most affected in South Minneapolis are getting the supplies that they need, you know, because of the stores that were damaged. The community has come together and made and has achieved the calls for donations 10 times. So it's really amazing to see our communities coming together and standing up and just standing together to clean up what has happened. Because although, yes, you know, it is affecting our communities down here, we understand where the frustrations come from. And that's through hundreds of years of oppression.
Days of unrest continue across the city after George Floyd, an African-American man, died in police custody last week. Native American Congresswomen Sharice Davids and Deb Holland released a statement Monday in solidarity with the Black community in response to the death of George Floyd. They said in the statement they share in the heartbreak and point to institutional racism and failures in the justice system. The Congresswomen also said Indian Country stands in solidarity with the Black community, adding their commitment to work toward meaningful action and change. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 2nd, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Ray Bodwell and Al Kahn. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegadoff, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with the issues in their community. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with your host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, The Bike Show features news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for a special rebroadcast of Counterspin, a program produced by the media watchdog organization FAIR.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News and to Totality of Circumstances on KBOO Portland. My name is Sam Bowman. This week we are playing a rerun of our Hindsight 2020 special. This special originally aired in January of this year, and it is a compilation of some news stories that were produced by KBOO volunteers from some protests at City Hall up through the major protest on June 4th downtown outside of City Hall. And we will be back in 2 weeks' time.
Activists and police had already clashed in Portland City Hall in late 2016 as the police contract neared approval. Within a month of Ted Wheeler starting his term as Portland mayor, council meetings began to frequently see interruptions from protesters, sudden recesses, and police calls. This report is from a January 25, 2017 council meeting, Wheeler's fourth. It was shortly after a homeless infant was found dead, and protesters were bringing their outrage to council chambers. The protesters gathered shortly before 9 a.m. outside City Hall to hold a memorial for the baby, which included speeches critical of city policies they say led to the death, as well as to the deaths of four other homeless people during the recent stretch of freezing weather. The group walked into chambers during its weekly Wednesday morning council meeting, where protest leader Mimi Gurman went to the front and started talking. She carried a tiny white coffin covered in flowers and interrupted the mayor as he read the rules for public testimony during meetings.
If folks would like to show your support or displeasure for a particular item or comment, please do so with a thumbs up or a thumbs down so that no one is disrupted, but we can see your expression. Carla, please call up the first citizen for communications today.
I'm here to disrupt this meeting.
If you're disrupting this meeting, then you are treading on other people's ability to speak. You're out of order. We're going to take a recess. Let's take a 10-minute recess.
That 10-minute recess turned into 40 minutes, during which City Hall was put on lockdown while a small crowd of media, Black Bloc demonstrators, and security gathered outside. Wheeler returned around 10 a.m. and said he would meet with the protesters after the meeting in the park across the street, if they left the chambers promptly, and threatened them with arrest. Most of the protesters left, while two dozen policemen filed into the building. Those who stayed behind to testify prompted Wheeler to call yet another recess when they refused to stick to the topic at hand and kept bringing up neglect of the homeless, police accountability, and the unresponsiveness of the city council to these and other concerns. Here is Star Stauffer testifying on a proposed street improvement project in Northwest Portland.
I'm ashamed right now that this is the representatives of my city, that is a more pressing issue, and how to spend that money on those projects and have another gentrifying developer come in into my community that my father and grandfather built with their hands and callously talk about bike lanes and street cracks when there's a baby dead. So, shame on you.
Thank you.
That was Star Stauffer, one of the demonstrators at today's city council meeting, seeking to draw attention to the deaths of homeless people on Portland streets. After more testimony, including Wheeler cutting the microphone on several of the demonstrators, the rest of the meeting went off with few interruptions. I'm Sam Bowman, KBOO Evening News. Mayor Wheeler would grow even less patient with protesters during his first year in office, eventually taking a series of measures to cut down on citizen participation in council hearings. The security firm G4S began checking bags and wanding people at the door. Rules were put in place allowing council to eject disruptive people and issue 2-month exclusions to repeat offenders. There were also quieter procedural changes, like no longer holding hearings with public comment when reports were presented to council, including, for example, audits of the police bureau. The killing of a young black man on Northeast 82nd Avenue on February 9, 2017, significantly ratcheted up the tension between the community and the city in council chambers and at protest actions across the city. Quanis Hayes, a 17-year-old known as Moose to his family and friends, was shot to death with an AR-15 rifle at close range by Portland police officer Andrew Hurst. Here, KBOO's Jenna Yokoyama speaks with a member of the PSU Student Action Network about planned protests soon after the killing of Quanis Hayes.
Last Thursday morning, 17-year-old Quanis Derek Hayes lost his life at the hands of Portland police. This Thursday evening, the Portland Student Action Network will be holding a rally called Justice for Quanis Hayes. The rally is being held to honor the life of Hayes as well as to hold the Portland Police Bureau accountable. With us in studio is Portland Student Action Network organizer and friend of Hayes, Shamaya Ibe. Thank you, Shamaya, for coming in, and condolences to you and the Hayes family. For this Thursday's rally there at the Park Blocks, you're going to be honoring the life of Quanis, and you also say that you're going to be holding the police bureau accountable. Can you talk a bit about the student network and wanting to hold the police accountable for Quanis's death?
Yeah, most definitely. This officer isn't the first of his, I guess you would say, bad behavior or bad cop behavior. He shot a mentally ill person back in 2013, and that shouldn't have even been allowed. He shouldn't still have his job, and it needs to end with Quanis.
And have you been a resident of Portland for like your whole life, or?
Yeah, I've lived in Portland all my life. I'm 18 years old, so.
And so for you, as someone who has been here in the city and now is having to go through this personal tragedy, what do you want to let your city leaders know in terms of holding the city accountable and getting justice for Kiwanis?
I feel like the mayor is behind us, and that's a good start, but we need more people. Like, we need the chief of police to be accountable and on our side. And what we really just want is, like, support and solidarity to recognize that this is a traumatic experience for his family, because the police are supposed to protect us, but they're killing our friends and our family and our brothers, and it's not okay.
Yeah, the initial reports that have been told by the police and have been in the major media narrative have really been sort of painting Kiwanis as somebody who was a suspect, very much like a criminal. And I'm just wondering if you, as someone who actually knew him personally, if you could speak about what it is to see him being characterized that way.
It hurts, because he was such a good person. He's so respectful and nice to anyone he came across. He's like, if you really knew him, he was just, his just presence just lit up a room. Like, he was just the light of the party. Like, I don't understand how this could have happened to Kiwanis. He didn't deserve this, and he doesn't deserve his name to be dragged through the mud like this. He was a young boy, and he was so close to graduation, and you guys took that away from him.
That was KBOO's Jenna Yokoyama speaking with PSU Student Action Network's Shamiah Eden about a planned protest in the wake of the police killing of Kiwanis Hayes in February 2017. An open community funeral was held for Hayes on March 24th of that year at Philadelphia Community Missionary Baptist Church, not long after Officer Hurst was found justified in killing him. It was presided over by Pastor Roy E. Clay, and the KBOO Evening News was there.
What happens when a boy dies, cousin?
Yeah.
At some point, y'all gotta stop playing with these people like they playing with y'all. Young men, young women, they ain't playing with y'all lives. Don't look at this casket and just think we lost news. We lost news. This is the reality of the war that's on y'all lives, and y'all still playing with these people. Y'all still acting like the Portland police and other police bureaus around this nation look at young black men differently. That's a lie. At some point, enough grades have to be stacked for y'all to get serious about the reality. Kiwanis, Cutting, son, I love you, man. I swear I wish I'd have just got on your helmet when I got home. Not because you was doing wrong, but because I understood that the minute you left by yourself, they would take your life from you. I swear, as God is my witness, Clay, your life will never be forgotten. And your legacy, this city legacy, is now you, cousin. They will eat of their destruction of your life, and we will do all we can to seek justice.
A few weeks later, KBOO's Teresa Mitchell spoke to Donna Hayes, Kiwanis' grandmother, outside of City Hall.
Kiwanis Hayes was fatally shot by police officer Andrew Hurst in February with an AR-15 rifle. Hayes' family, along with Don't Shoot Portland and other community organizers, are demanding that the case be put before a federal court. KBOO's Teresa Mitchell spoke with Donna Hayes, Quintus Hayes' grandmother, about the case.
You tried to talk to the city council earlier today?
No, that was last Wednesday.
Oh, last Wednesday.
Uh-huh. And so they wouldn't let me. They wouldn't let me go at 2 o'clock, neither time. So what we did, we went over to the process and got a councilwoman to okay it. And so I got May 24th at 2 o'clock. They told me 10:05, but they changed it to 2 o'clock, which I'm glad. Because, it's the anniversary of a young man, I think he was like either 22 or 25, was killed by police. They drug his name through the mud, talked about he was had a felony and that he was a criminal and drug addict. But they shot him, okay? They say they give a warrant. So they having that on the 24th, so they'll be able to come after that march they having on the 24th, because it's at 2 o'clock. But for me, I'm looking forward to coming to the city council, because I let my daughter do the talk. It was her child that she lost. But I lost something, too. That was my grandchild. That was a close grandchild of mine. You know, he's up in age. We could talk. We had an understanding, you know. I knew he loved me. And I lost him. On his knees with his hands in the air. I read the transcripts. It's so many conflicting views. In the last one that I read, because I haven't went past 275, I'm having a hard time with it, the chief came down and said, well, when they lied, they said, oh, only one person was speaking at the time. The chief said, I heard everybody speaking. So we got a child on his knees with his hands up in the air, confused. They got a person, the only person with a lethal, that does lethal, the lethal weapon, was a person that had it last time that the government is in on because of him. You know, why would they give him a gun? They could have gave anybody on the planet a gun other than him. Let him hold a beanbag or the taser. Because I'd rather see my grandson hit with a beanbag, whining and complaining about how slow he is, or the taser that he'll remember to chill every time he think about it. I'd rather have that, because he would have been alive. We'd have had something to talk about. Yeah, I told him he was on his knees. They gave different descriptions of he was squatting, he was on his knees, he was on his belly. What's true? We had one policeman saying, let me go through my notes. So he got notes. What I don't understand is the grand jury process. I don't understand it. It's one way for policemen and another way for other people. Because other people, you cannot be there. You cannot have a lawyer there. But he can be there. He had his lawyer there. He had the union there.
So he had representation, and we had none. He was my great-grandson. None. We weren't there. We weren't permitted to participate in it at all.
And now the big lie that's going around now is the police officer said, I told him that he shouldn't be carrying a replica gun. That's a lie. Okay.
Was it the same cop that shot him with a rifle that said that?
No, this was another female there. I talked to that lady. She talked to my daughter on the night that my grandson was sitting in a stolen car. His friend had stolen a car, and he's sitting in the passenger seat. That's all he was. That's all they told us. Oh, he was just sitting in the passenger seat. We're sending him home. So he was coming to my house. I'm staying with my mother. He was coming to our house. I had called his uncles and everybody coming. Come on and get Moose, because he can't stay here. It's not enough room. First of all, he never made it to the house. After they said that they seen him, and I called a couple of times. They said, oh, he should almost be there. But he never made it. But never once did they mention a replica gun. I think that would have been important to tell his mother he's sitting in a stolen car with a replica gun. But they didn't tell her. So I don't believe it was he had a replica gun in that car.
So you were calling this afternoon. You're calling for a national investigation?
Yes.
That's what we want.
We want the federal government to investigate. This is bull. This is the same man they had to come in and investigate before. So I don't understand why they're not jumping into this right away. We got big idiot back here shooting up people again.
Yeah, they filed suit against Portland, the federal government, for the same thing, misbehaving with the police.
And it involved that man, Andrew Hurst, and two other people. It involved them. And now he's back into another one. And they should be back. Because I guarantee you, give him 3, 4, 5 more years, somebody else going to be die at his hand. You know, that little boy, Christopher, I cannot pronounce his last name. We got a blog, a little article, and he gone and he puffed the magic dragon. He's gone. We don't hear nothing else about it. How I found out that he's still in people's mind was I'm sitting on Facebook again, and they having a memorial 1 year from his death. All these shootings, I think it's all what they're doing to keep it quiet, because they don't want to mess with tourism. They don't want to mess with the people that's coming and moving in. Them big old tall buildings they're building in North Portland, Northeast Portland, they got to be filled. We can't afford them, so they got to be filled. So let's not scare the people. Let them keep coming.
That was Donna Hayes speaking with KBOO's Teresa Mitchell in March of 2017. Towards the end of that clip, she references the killing of teenager Christopher Kalonji by Clackamas County Sheriff's deputies in early 2016, and the upcoming anniversary demonstration in his name. Hayes would soon connect with Kalonji's mother, Irene Kalonji, and several other families and activists that had lost loved ones to state violence to form a community group called Pacific Northwest Family Circle. Family Circle, Don't Shoot Portland, Portland Equity in Action, Standing Up for Racial Justice, and other community groups fueled increased scrutiny of the role of district attorneys, police unions, and other background actors in the lack of accountability for cops who kill and mistreat civilians. KBOO reporters tracked the uses of deadly force by cops in Oregon during the years 2018 and 2019, and noticed a sharp increase during those 2 years in the number of instances of deadly force and people dying in police custody. In the 10 years 2010 through 2019, there were an average of 25.6 deadly force incidents across the state, resulting in 13.6 deaths. Both statistics peaked dramatically over the past 2 years, with 43 incidents in 2018 resulting in 21 deaths, and 35 incidents in 2019 resulting in 22 deaths. This was up from 27 incidents and 12 deaths in 2017. Political violence also escalated during these years, especially that driven by white supremacists. In late May of 2017, a man stabbed Ricky Best, Taliesin Namkhai-Meche, and Micah Fletcher on a MAX train after they interrupted his racist threats against two young students of color, one wearing a hijab. Best and Namkhai-Meche were killed. Public attention quickly zeroed in on an upcoming right-wing demonstration to take place in front of City Hall. Attempts to convince Mayor Wheeler to revoke the permit for the rally in the wake of the MAX killings were thwarted by the federal government, which owns Terry Schrunk Plaza. The rally was met with three large contingents of counter-protesters surrounding Schrunk Plaza on three sides. The two sides were mostly kept apart by several law enforcement agencies in full paramilitary power. The following report from this event betrays where my head was at in 2017. This was all pretty new or recent for me, which is clear from my liberal use of the word Antifa to describe different organizations and individuals wearing the same clothing, to my general focus on the spectacle and the potential for violence. The rally yesterday in Terry Schrunk Plaza brought in a number of right-wing groups and political strains, from the so-called Patriot Movement to belligerent white nationalists to families from Kaiser wearing Trump hats. It was not scheduled to begin until 2 p.m., but by the time KBOO reporters arrived at 11:30, groups were already setting up in the plaza and across Madison Street and Chapman Square. In Chapman, dozens of black-clad, masked, anti-fascist protesters were talking, blasting music, setting up their medical space, and giving away free ice cream. At City Hall, across 4th Avenue from Schrunk Plaza, only a handful of people were setting up for the noon rally. However, soon after noon, this had swelled to probably 200 or 300 people as the police cordoned off the sidewalks around Schrunk Plaza across the street. 12:30 p.m.
hour and a half before the alt-right rally is supposed to start. Everything's pretty much underway, though. Well, we're in the middle of the rally against hate. Portland United against hate, I should say.
Organizers for that rally, called the Portland Stands United Against Hate rally, contacted the other two counter-protest rallies ahead of June 4th to ask that they respect its nonviolent intentions. The other rallies are the Anti-Fascists, or Antifa, set up in Chapman Square, and the smallest rally, Portland Labor United Against the Fascists, which was about 100 strong at any given time during the day, and set up across 3rd Avenue from Shrunk Plaza. At the corners of the Labor rally where 3rd Avenue intersects Jefferson and Madison Streets, there was an interminable series of interactions between counter-protesters and individuals or groups coming over from Shrunk Plaza. At one point, one of the Labor organizers began this chant.
We are here to give voice to those that the fascists would destroy, but they cannot. I'm going to read the names of some of the ones that we will not forget today. Juanice Hayes.
We will not forget.
Ricky Best.
We will not forget.
Taylor Namkai Meche.
We will not forget.
Mulligata Sarawa.
We will not forget.
Ricky Best.
Across the street in Shrunk Plaza, right-wing demonstrators could be seen yelling, "Who?" and "I already forgot." While at the Labor rally, I saw about a half dozen young men buzz the edges of the Antifa rally in Chapman Square, kitty-corner from us. Many around me identified these men as Proud Boys, a white nationalist group that enjoys, among other things, antagonizing Antifa. It was hard to tell what instigated the interaction, which caused a wave of Antifa to surge towards 3rd Avenue. Later, over in Chapman Square, I asked a bystander named Ethan, who was there as a counter-protester, but otherwise unaffiliated, what he saw.
So you saw some, was it the Proud Boys going by?
It seemed to be, yeah.
Buzzing the edges.
Or? On the corner, they had there were two individuals who came over into a large group of leftist labor folks and just kind of seemed like they maybe wanted a confrontation. One of them had a shirt on that did say Proud Boys. The other one had just kind of general regalia that you might see, a Police Lives Matter flag and a GoPro camera strapped to their chest. And so some folks kind of just interrupted that and led some chants and push them out of that area.
I spent the rest of the day moving back and forth between Chapman Square and the Labor rally. It was fairly easy to walk along the front line of the Antifa protest facing Shrunk Plaza. City police in full riot gear stood 4 or 5 feet apart, occasionally charging into the Antifa line to seize, in at least one case, a homemade shield. It wasn't all Antifa in Chapman Square either. At one point, I ran into Ibrahim Mubarak, one of the founders and longtime leaders of the Right to Dream 2 camp in downtown Portland. He was standing on the front line holding a sign in front of the police.
I'm with Ibrahim Mubarak. He's holding a sign. What's this say?
It says, "Stop the sweeps, we need sleep."
That's a reference to the...
Yeah, to the homeless people, about how they criminalize the people for living on the streets.
And how has this been so far that you've seen? I noticed there was just they charged in
for
a second.
I think on both sides, they need to learn to accept differences. Everybody have an opinion, and that's your opinion. As long as you're not being derogatory or being discrimination or causing any physically or bodily harm to people, you should be able to say what you want to say.
Further east, near the corner of 3rd and Madison, where most of the altercations that I witnessed occurred, I ran into fellow KBOO reporter Linda Olson Osterlund.
How have things been here?
I think they've been actually great. It's been a continual growth of people against the alt-right. At this point, it looks like on three sides of their demonstration, there are hundreds, I think it's probably thousands of people are down here now at this time against the alt-right and for many other things. And it's great. There's legal here, there's food here, there's medical here, and there's lots of people from lots of backgrounds saying no to the fascists. So I'm really excited.
And
I'm scared. The police are all armored up.
I'm looking at the police. I see DHS. I've seen county folks.
I've seen state troopers, and I wanted to just change that ST to ORM, and it would be stormtrooper on the back of their
Those are the guys on the trucks, right?
Yeah, I've seen them twice deploy them here, but now they've moved them a little away. They've moved them around this corner. I think the area of concern for the police keeps switching from one part to another, and I think that benefits us who want to make sure our voices are heard.
All right. And have you seen any altercations or anything?
No.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, I did see one. Someone from the alt-right side, there were like two people behind them. They appeared to want to break through the police line to get into the street, and they were immediately tackled, and they were hauled away, I think, by county uniform, the yellow colored back on the back of them.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Linda.
Yeah, thank you for being down here.
I did see some isolated violent incidents in Chapman Square. At one point, when people began shouting, "Rat," and "We've got a mole," a man came running towards the corner of 3rd and Madison out of the Antifa crowd and was eventually tripped and stomped on briefly by about a half dozen black-clad demonstrators before escaping past the police line. This was easily the most extreme bit of violence I saw while I was in Chapman Square. However, not everybody there characterized the day as being overall nonviolent. Ethan, the man I spoke to about the Proud Boys earlier, had this to say.
But overall, you say it's been pretty peaceful.
You know, I might have a counter to that, and I wouldn't say that it's been peaceful.
Oh, yeah.
Just noting that we do live in a police state, and there have been militarized police officers from not only Department of Homeland Security and Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, but Portland Police here that have been visually terrorizing folks and making unlawful arrests. So they also have an LRAD, which you can hear in the background, which is a long-range acoustic device. So I'd say that it hasn't been the show that Berkeley was. There haven't been a mass number of people who have been brawling in the streets.
There you go. Well, thank you so much, Ethan.
Yeah, thank you.
Later, police would round up dozens of people in a so-called kettling maneuver, including journalists and bystanders, and would justify their uses of force against counter-protesters with pictures of makeshift weapons gathered at the site. These events would become a familiar sight throughout much of the next 2 years.
That was the first